Good day, listening public. Today is December 2nd, 2020, and thank you for listening to General Disclosure, the podcast from SAN. My name is Dan Silverman, and I'm joined, as always, by co-host Cheryl Dev. Cheryl.
Hi, everybody. Sorry, Dan. Cheryl. Jumped all over.
That's all right. I had another way of asking you, but that's fine. Today, our guest is Lindsay McKenzie. She's the technology reporter at Inside Higher Ed. Although given the broad variety of articles she writes, I guess her editor defines that position pretty broadly. But anyway, Lindsay is one of the ACE reporters on state authorization, and we're so glad to have her. Lindsay, welcome.
Thank you. That was a very sweet introduction. Yes, it is an extremely broad beat. I cover pretty much anything to do with digital learning, anything that could conceivably involve computers, which is pretty much all of higher ed. So it's extremely broad.
Exactly. And I've often wondered about that. I mean, is a professor sending an email? Is that a hybrid course? You know, anyway, but we'll hopefully we'll stay out of those waters. But I'll start with two questions that I start pretty much all of these conversations with is defining your career, however you define it. You clearly have a lot of talents and ideas. Why do you do this?
Why do I do this? Oh, it's tough. I mean, I really wanted to be a doctor and I didn't get into medical school. And I was like, what do I do now? And I loved science and wanted to write about science. And through reading a lot of great science journalism, got really interested in journalism. So it was a really roundabout way of getting into what I do. And now I write about higher education, obviously. So I get to talk to professors all the time, which is amazing. I can just call up people who are world-renowned experts and they very generously give me their time. So it's great. It's learning something new every day. It's being able to help people understand complex things like state authorization. And it's really fun. It's a really interesting job, and I'm so glad that I get to do it for a living and I get paid.
What's an example of a science journalist who inspired you?
I really like the work of Ivan Oransky. He started a blog called Retraction Watch, and this is so niche. I don't know if anyone will have even read it, but it's tracking all of the journal articles that are retracted from journals, and a lot of the time it's for things like academic misconduct. It's just kind of an area of journalism that is so niche. Not many people care about it, but I think it's really important that scientists are held accountable. And that kind of transcends into higher ed more broadly, right? Academics do a lot of academic work, and it's really important that that academic work is valued. And yeah, I just think the work he does is really interesting. It's very nerdy.
Do you know of Brian Nosek at UVA, the reproducibility project?
Yeah, I do.
Yes,
yeah,
so I followed him a little bit, and that's same idea. Very interesting.
Ed Young at the Atlantic is also great. He's a fantastic storyteller.
Oh, okay, great. We'll have to put a couple of those names in our show notes so our listeners can
check it out.
Can have their horizons expanded. But if journalism were to vaporize tomorrow, then what would you do?
I think I would like to be a librarian. I talk to lots of librarians and they're fascinating people. And the more I learn about that profession, the more interesting I think it is, the way that it's sort of like linked to such an ancient practice, but so forward-looking, so technical. It's a lot about business as well as just, you know, digital archiving and working with people. It's a kind of service profession. I just think it's a really interesting job and something I never would have considered as a young person. But the more I find out about it, the more I think, I think I would actually really enjoy that work.
You have a piece today on Inside of Higher Ed about the CDC Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices meeting and vote yesterday on how to prioritize COVID vaccines. And at the end of the piece, you write that although the CDC committee were widely watched, U.S. officials have previously said states will have the final say in who gets early vaccines. And I promise there's a state authorization link here too. So this federal state dynamic that you see here, do you see that any similarity with higher ed regulation more generally?
I do. And coming from the UK, it's something that I think is really interesting to me, because we just don't have the same kind of level of state independence. I mean, the UK obviously has independent countries and devolution, but it's a completely different system. And I was quite surprised by how contentious some of these issues are, state by state, how differently states approach different topics. It's really been interesting. I feel like I've learned a lot about American politics through following higher education policy at the state and federal level.
What was your first state authorization story, and when was it?
I think it must have been the year I started, which was 2017. I'm trying to remember. I think it may have been about the fact that California didn't seem to want to participate in NCSARA, which is still the case, and kind of exploring why that was. I think it's still a really interesting topic, and there's a lot of tension there between the institutions that want to be part of NCSARA and the groups that really feel strongly that NCSARA isn't providing strong enough student protections, which is a really interesting dynamic. So I think that was the first one, but I may be wrong.
What are other regulatory beats that you enjoy covering, and how do they tie in or not tie in with state authorization?
Yeah, I don't cover a huge amount of policy. If I do, it tends to tie into data or kind of cybersecurity breaches, that kind of thing. So it's pretty niche. I have written a little bit about the GI Bill, kind of in the context of online learning. But most of the time, if there's a policy topic I'm asked to write, it is about state authorization. And I'm not quite sure how it kind of fell on my shoulders, but it's become my thing, which is great. I mean, I love that I'm considered the person to go to within NCSARA about that topic. I think it's very flattering when people ask you to do something. And I think it's quite a challenging topic, so I'm proud that I've become that person.
Well, I think your story there mirrors that of our members. It kind of fell on their lap,
yeah,
and they took it. You know, I don't think anybody grows up dreaming of doing this. So, but you just touched on a couple of other topics that San has worked a little bit on, and two areas in particular in Cheryl's wheelhouse, which is cybersecurity and GI and military issues. Cheryl, do you have any follow-ups on those, either of those?
I understand where she's coming from about Lindsay. You know, you're addressing these as very interesting, intricate, nuanced sorts of issues with a lot of things that you can, you know, really dive into. I do want to point out, though, that one of the things that I appreciated being interviewed by you, and I think it's been almost 2 years ago, we were talking about state authorization, and you were talking about how fascinating you thought this topic was. And I remember going, oh, God bless you, because, you know, we need, you know, people to find us and find our work interesting. So, but you're right. And, you know, all of these, you find such fabulous nuances. So they aren't very black and white. There's so much gray, and, you know, trying to make that work. And then, you know, you were talking about how the states vary so widely, and, you know, California is not participating in reciprocity at this time. And the states even vary in terms of how they look at this. I think it's interesting, too, that Canada, you know, they have a very strong sense of their provincial and territory management of their work, not necessarily education specifically, but just in general, how they manage their province or territory. And so, you know, I find that very interesting that the United States and Canada contrast that to what you were saying about the UK. Mm-hmm. So, so I guess you're sharing with us that the UK has a strong nationalist government structure.
They kind of do. It's just very different. We don't really have an accreditation structure. And actually, I would say the online learning landscape in the UK is not as developed as the US. It's just a very different landscape, and obviously dominated by state-funded mm-hmm. institutions. We don't have so much of a private system. It's very different, and that's part of why I find it so interesting. I don't know if an American would find this topic maybe quite as interesting as I do, but that's where the interest comes from for me.
Well, you're absolutely right, though, when you compare and contrast, you know, the priorities of different countries, how they manage it, which is why, you know, we talk about institutions in the United States that might have students who are wishing to take online courses from other countries. And we talk about how the oversight by those countries could be very different. And it's a different, it not only may they have different oversight rules, but they have different culture and expectations. And so, you know, it's in the United States, you know, it varies, but I think we still have a common culture about education, where I think the variety of international opportunities is very different.
Mm-hmm. And I do feel sorry for the US institutions trying to deal with things like the GDPR and mm-hmm. the European regulation. It's very different, and it does get very complicated. I don't envy the people that have to think about that.
You're absolutely right.
So Cheryl mentioned, Lindsay, that you interviewed her at one time. How do you cultivate, how do you find and cultivate your sources?
Most of the time, I start with Google searches. I find people that have written about the topic that I'm interested in, or I look at other reporters writing. Who have they spoken to? I'll go to my editor and my colleagues and ask who they would recommend I speak to. It's really a case of just kind of crowdsourcing the best people to speak to, and then hopefully trying to build a relationship with them where, you know, if you call them up, they're kind enough to give you some time, and most people are, which I do really appreciate. It's difficult with state authorization for me to speak to individual administrators at the university level, because often they can't really say how they're doing. Like, quite a lot of my stories are about implementing regulation, and I know from what I'm hearing that a lot of people might be struggling with implementation, but no one wants to put their hand up and say, I'm the one who's struggling, because then they become, you know, a potential focus of scrutiny. And I totally understand why people would be hesitant to speak to me. So that is the challenge. So I speak to people like Cheryl, who has a really good bird's eye view of what's happening. I also speak to consultants sometimes who might be paid by universities to do some of the legwork. But it's a challenge sometimes. And I'm always, whenever I speak to people, I often ask them, you know, who else should I speak to? And I really appreciate contact suggestions.
Well, it's interesting. We have some outspoken members, and Cheryl, we'll have to put our heads together and see if we think any of them would ever be willing to. Because while Lindsay, the dynamic you're describing is very, very reasonable and very common about not wanting to raise your hand to attract scrutiny of any regulators. I don't know. We may have a few in the group, Cheryl, that might be willing to speak their mind. So we'll have to think about that.
I would love that. Yeah, that would be great.
Well, the funny thing about that, though, I should share with you, Lindsay, is that whenever we meet, we often go, safe space here, you know, because we're all working towards compliance. And so, you know, sometimes they're willing to share within the group because, you know, we're all trying to figure out, you know, what are the best ways to move forward correctly. People share what works and what doesn't work. But yes, I mean, what Dan's describing, I'm sure we have some folks that will share. And some of them that do share, as a matter of fact, on our website, we have what we call the Sensational Awards. And those are people who have done really good work, have submitted their work for review by our SAN Awards Committee, and they're awarded and willing to share, you know, that this is how they've, you know, worked to solve different problems. And so we often point to them as the volunteers, if you will, of, you know, how work can be done. And so they may be people that you might want to chat with.
That's a great tip. Yeah, I will check it out.
But another challenge too is that oftentimes the people implementing these regulations are kind of lower on the organizational chart, and therefore might not necessarily feel comfortable speaking for their university or be used to being approached even.
That's definitely true. Yeah.
And I see that.
And also, sometimes I contact an institution, and if I can't find the right person, I'll go through the press office, and the press office might not know who is working on this issue, or have even ever heard of this issue. So you have to kind of spend some time explaining and kind of throwing out some job titles, and sometimes it's a dead end. But absolutely, I don't expect everyone to be super media savvy. So that is something I run into. I try and reassure people that I'm not, you know, trying to make them, trying to trip them up, or, you know, I want everyone to sound smart in my articles. I don't like, you know, making people seem foolish. You know, I think that's not my objective. And I think that's a concern people have, that they might say the wrong thing. Also too, when I'm reporting on something brand new, people might be uncertain about it, and that's totally understandable too. I mean, you want to be certain about what you're speaking about, so I totally get where people come from on that.
Well, this is the last question I have, but Cheryl, you're welcome to come with any other follow-ups. In your time at Inside of Higher Ed, have there been some trends in higher ed regulation or policy that have emerged that have surprised you in some way?
Yeah, I write quite a lot about online program management, which is when institutions outsource the management of online programs. Maybe they need help launching new programs or running an existing program and growing it. I think that's a really interesting area. And I think there may be some focus on that with the new administration, but from a regulatory perspective, the basis on which the companies exist or allowed to operate is really kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Technical. It's not a really strong foundation. Like, it's something that the education department could potentially overturn at some point. I don't think they will, because there's such an infrastructure around these companies and all of the degree programs and some really great partnerships between these companies and institutions. But I think that has been a really interesting area to learn about and something I will be watching moving forward.
Cheryl, do you have any other questions for Lindsay?
Let's see. With having covered state authorization, you know, you talked a little bit about California not participating in reciprocity, but what do you think is the most surprising thing that's come out of this kind of back and forth? As you've probably seen the history of the federal regulation, it took 10 years to get us to a point of an effective regulation, and it came from consensus. What do you think is the most surprising thing that you've seen over this time period?
I mean, that it is literally a decade, right, of back mm-hmm. and forth. And I actually go back into the archive sometimes and read stories from, you know, the early days of Inside Higher Ed relatively by my predecessors. And it's often the same discussion topics, which is really interesting. Mm-hmm. It's interesting how much longevity the issues have, how these continue to be things that people really care about and discuss closely and carefully. I think that's really interesting, that this issue is just, it keeps coming up again and again, and it continues to be really difficult. So I think that's interesting. I'm always struck by how carefully worded language around state authorization is, and it does make it quite challenging to write about sometimes, because you just have to be really specific. So talking about something like what state is a student in, what is their location, you know, you have to really pinpoint. You can't just be vague about it. So as a writer, that's something that's kind of top of my mind when I'm writing about this issue. And I don't know if it translates into the most exciting reading, but I try, and certainly inspired by your blogs, Cheryl, they're really good. I like how you try and build pop culture into there and sports analogies, and yeah, it's a really hard topic to make super interesting, but I think you do it really well.
Well, that's nice of you. Thank you. We do try to have fun, right, Dan?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's something we try to inject humor where possible. And, you know, I always appreciate Dan's sense of humor too. He adds a lot to what we do, but I mean, it's rather dry. And so, you know, we try to find the humor in it where we can. And it also helps you remember things if some humor is tied to it.
That's true. I would add that's one thing I have been kind of surprised by, that every time I write about state authorization, or I think I wrote in the summer about the new professional licensure disclosures, and I had tons of emails from people like, hey, does this apply to me?
Yeah.
Constant surprise. And I'm like, I think it does. I'm not the right person to ask, but yeah, I think so. So it feels rewarding that I'm helping to spread the word about these things that people need to be paying attention to. It's not an area of my beat that gets the most clicks, as I'm sure you might imagine. But I feel like it's really important to cover, and I hope I help in explaining it to some people that might not have understood it before or been aware of it.
Well, we appreciate the work that you do, that's for sure.
Thank you.
Very much. Thank you so much, Lindsay. And we will we'll leave it there as far as our conversation with you. But please do stick around for our last two very short segments, if you'd like. The next one we have here is out of left field, which is when I take something that I've come across and it doesn't seem like it has any relation to higher ed policy or regulation or technology and try to tie it in. I realized as I thought about the last couple that they've turned into almost mini sermons, and I'm not gonna go as long this time or as didactic, but I'm gonna pose a couple of questions for our members and listeners. So. I don't know about you, but I read the car review column, the Wall Street Journal, every weekend by Dan Neal. I am not interested in cars. And when he starts writing about torque and suspension and cubic inches of this and that, I skip right over it. But I read it because it is a humor column masquerading as a car review column. And I've just been wondering about that. Why don't they call it what it is? Getting a little closer to education, my daughter's preschool recently had its grandparents' day, which when you first think about it, oh, what a nice way to include the whole family. But then you look a little closer and it's run by the development office and is simply a development opportunity, which is fine. Schools need money, I get it. But I'm wondering, you know, why these things get called by something else. And so if you could think about it, your institutions, are there aspects of the way a tech is used or policies implementation that are really about something but masquerading as something else? And if so, why? So I'll just leave that as a lingering question. And now we move on to everybody's favorite, Cheryl on musicals. Cheryl, what are you hearing about any reopening plans?
Well, I heard that the West End in London will be able to open this month. I don't know the truth of that, but I've heard that that is a possibility. And then okay, well, see, there you go. I'll let Lindsay go on that one. Lindsay, what do you know?
I don't know. I, as far as I know, London is still on lockdown because my brother is there right now and he's trapped in his house. But that would be great. I love musicals and have a lot of friends actually who are actors. So I hope that's true.
And that would be great, because what I'm hearing too is that Back to the Future, the musical, yes, this is a real thing. Back to the Future, the musical is supposed to open on the West End, I think in March. And Roger Bart, who was the voice of, let's see, Hercules in the cartoon Hercules when he was young and sang Go the Distance, family favorite in this house. He was also Dr. Frankenstein in the movie musical of Young Frankenstein. He will play the crazy inventor part. And then I did hear also that speculation is that the first Broadway show that will open next summer will be Hamilton. But that is just, you know, that's the internet. Who knows? But that's what I hear.
Yeah, Cheryl, I did quiz Lindsay on her sources. I'm not going to do the same for you. We'll just
go with the internet.
Remain confidential. So other than Aaron Sorkin, is there a screenwriter or TV writer who you'd like to see dip into the musicals?
Oh my.
Are you fans of Fleabag?
There you go.
I would love to see Phoebe Waller-Bridge write a musical. I think that'd be awesome.
That would be. There you go.
Okay, I'm not familiar with Fleabag. What is that?
It is a British comedy, I guess. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit dark. It's about a woman. It just follows this woman who's kind of, I don't know, Shel, how would you describe her? Like a little bit eccentric?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Phoebe Waller-Bridge also helped to write Killing Eve, I believe. And I can't think what else she's done, but kind of dark British humor, I think, is how I would describe it. A little bit irreverent.
And they won many awards about a year ago. I think the Emmys, like maybe a year ago. And it's on Netflix.
It's very good.
It's very good. Yep.
Well, Lindsay, we'll let you have the last word here. Is there a musical? What's been your favorite musical of the last 5 years?
Oh, so hard. I mean, it's really embarrassing. I don't know if it really counts as a musical, but I really love Frozen 2. And
I love it. Yeah.
If you have Disney Plus, there is a fascinating documentary about how the animators made Frozen 2. And I made my boyfriend watch it, and we ended up watching it twice because he loved it so much. And I don't know how that happened, but it's so interesting to see how they made it. And it's very good.
I'm right there with you.
It's worth watching. Even if you don't like Frozen, I think you would enjoy the Making of Frozen documentary that's on Disney Plus.
Fantastic.
All right. Well, Lindsay McKenzie, thank you so much for being with us. Cheryl, thank you as always for co-hosting.
Thanks, Dan. Thank you, Lindsay, for being with us. Really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you so much. You too.
All right. Talk to you guys later. Bye-bye.